indictments, scandals, shady back alley negotiations. It's just another day in the life of an antiquities curator. Sharon Waxman, a longtime foreign correspondent and a former New York Times culture reporter, looks at the web of intrigue around the sale and acquisition of ancient art in her new book called Loot, The Battle Over the Stolen Treasures of the Ancient World. It's published by Times Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Waxman to the show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So given the title of your book, do you think we should think of most of the antiquities in Western museums as loot?
Not necessarily, but I did mean the title to be provocative, and it's got a big picture of Nefertiti on the cover. She's in the Berlin Museum, and it is made to make you stop and think in a different way about the pieces that we look at and adore so much in our great museums.
I thought about it years ago when I fell in love with a vase at the Metropolitan Museum, a Greek vase painter who's called the Berlin Painter. And he's called the Berlin Painter because there's a famous piece in the they've connected him to a piece in a Berlin museum, mm-hmm. but not the Athenian painter, which is what he really was.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the countries you focus on in the book is Egypt. How much would you say has actually been stolen from Egyptian sites, and when did the stealing begin?
Oh, well, Egypt is a rather notorious example of the plunder of the ancient world. Egypt was rediscovered by Napoleon, actually, at the very start of the 19th century. And he had brought with him about 150 scientists that were called savants, who were meant to bring the ideals of the French Revolution with him. So these people were engineers and botanists and painters and urban planners, and they were meant to help the Egyptians kind of reorganize a la Revolution, you know. And what they did was they laid eyes, though, for the first time on the wonders of ancient Egypt. It had been centuries since Europe had even stepped foot, really, in any significant numbers in Egypt. And they sent back these unbelievable images of Egypt, and this set off this wave of Egyptomania, essentially, in Europe, the first wave of it in the past, one of many, as we have every time King Tut comes on over here. And so basically what happened was led by the consul generals of the great empires of France and England, we just started this wholesale pillaging and looting of Egypt. And these form the core of the collections, in fact, in Italy and Egypt, in France and in England, that they don't tell you this, of course, in the museums, but this is...
They're spoils of war.
It wasn't war. They just took it. I mean, nobody asked the Egyptians what they thought, and the country was under Ottoman power at that time, but it was really a steeplechase, actually, between the great powers, between France and England, to grab what they could for their national museums.
Well, should we declare a statute of limitations on some of these
there is
pieces
one.
In question?
There is one. UNESCO has passed a convention and uses 1970 as a cutoff date for not collecting antiquities that lack provenance since that time. But there are some pieces that, particularly Egypt's very charismatic and not shy at all, Chief of Antiquities Zahi Hawass, and he has decided that there are five pieces that are so integral to the cultural identity of Egypt that whatever the conditions under which they left the country, they need to come back. And the bust of Nefertiti and the Rosetta Stone, which are, of course, two of the most famous pieces from Egypt in the world, those are two of the five that he has decided need to come back regardless.
And in Greece, there's a similar claim on the Elgin marbles for the same reason?
Yeah, the Parthenon sculptures
were... Because it's so important to the
Parthenon. Well, there's a lot of reasons. Essentially, it has to do with the Greek cultural identity and the feeling that it's their cultural patrimony. The Greeks have been asking for the Parthenon sculptures to be returned basically since the 1820s, since they became independent. And they were taken from 1802 for about 4 years, again, when it was part of the Ottoman Empire. So but there's also kind of an architectural argument or an archaeological argument, which is that the integrity of the building, some might say, would demand that the sculptures be reunited.
On the other hand, the British claim that they have protected these sculptures. If they had been left, they probably would have been melted down, in effect, by the pollution
yeah.
of Athens.
And
it's been argued that more people are likely to view an artifact if it's in a European or an American museum.
Yeah, look, there are very good arguments to be wielded on both sides. One of the things, the book is absolutely not a polemic for one side or the other. It's really, I go in as a reporter who goes to the places where the museums are, who goes to the countries that are demanding pieces back, and really tries to get to the heart of what is at stake here and what are these arguments really about. So the museums are extraordinarily good at self-serving arguments like, oh, well, they would have been destroyed anyway. Well, Lord Elgin had no idea that pollution in the 60s and 70s was going to disintegrate some of the sculptures, number one. And
he just wanted these masterpieces.
Well, the story of Lord Elgin, which is in the book, is really an amazing story. I presumed he was this rich lord who sort of gallivanted off to the east and took down these sculptures and took them back and lived happily ever after. In fact, the story of the taking of the Elgin marbles is this incredible tragedy and a story of true obsession, because Lord Elgin ended up, it ruined his life, this obsession over the possessing the beauty of these sculptures for the benefit of improving the British taste. That was what his goal was, so they could have better teacups and tea towels and that sort of thing. And it ended up impoverishing him. He ended up in a corner of his estate in Scotland. His wife, who was a beautiful heiress, left him for his best friend. He lost his title, and he ended up with syphilis, which ate his nose off his face. So it really was not altogether a salutary pursuit for him. And of course, they hacked half the sculptures off what was widely considered to be the most perfect building ever erected in Western civilization. But my point about the British Museum is, while they do acknowledge when you go to visit the sculptures, and yes, it is true that many people do see them at the British Museum, and they do acknowledge with a pamphlet in the galleries where they are that there is a dispute over them. But they are, again, very selective, as all the museums are, very selective in telling you the histories of these pieces. And they don't tell you, for example, that they bleached the marbles and they scraped them in the 1930s and they did damage to the sculptures themselves. And it's in the past, but it happened.
Now, what is the situation? There's a legal battle involving the Elgin marbles. There are legal battles involving the Egyptian treasures that Zahi Hawass has implemented.
We're not at lawsuits yet over the Egyptian demands, although they're in the process of trying to pass a law that would allow them to start suing people. It's really Italy that has been the most aggressive, Turkey as well, in filing lawsuits. And of course, many of your listeners probably know that the antiquities curator of the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles has been on trial for criminal charges for more than, I'd say, 2.5 years now with Marion True. And her case is still not resolved, despite the fact that the Getty has sort of caved and returned 40 major pieces to Italy. But her case is still pending. But in Greece's case, the Parthenon sculptures, it's not a legal case. It's a case of morality, if you like, from the Greek point of view. And they now have opened a state-of-the-art, beautiful museum, the New Acropolis Museum, at the base of the Parthenon, where they have installed the half of the sculptures that they have, and the ones that are in the British Museum they have in plaster and covered by this, like, shroud. So that's how...
In the case of Marion True, when she was being indicted on criminal charges in Italy, the Italian prosecutor called her not Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but very similar.
Yeah.
That was rather hard.
It's been very harsh, I think.
It's not about Marion True, but yeah, she was just a convenient way to go after the museums.
I think that's exactly right. They said that to me. The prosecutor himself said that to me. I interviewed him in Rome on the eve, actually, coincidentally, of the deal that they made to get the 40 pieces back. And he told me, well, you know, probably these charges can go away because we don't have anything against Marion True herself, but, you know, they didn't listen when we sent them polite letters. So what were we supposed to do? So Marion True, he pretty much is saying that she became essentially the scapegoat, because she, of course, didn't make those decisions on her own. She answered to a board of trustees and to the director of the museum, and that's been what she said, or her people say privately, and it just sort of stands to reason to me that a curator who did her job and collected antiquities, remember, she's not accused of sort of lining her pockets or having a side business. She is accused of criminal charges of theft and fraud for having done her job, essentially.
Well, then this is a warning to all museums have added to their antiquities collections recently. And in the case of the Getty, since it's a fairly new museum, pretty much all the antiquities they're going to get are called into question.
A great deal of them. If you ask the Italian prosecutor, he sort of smiles and says, yes, we could empty that museum if we chose to. I mean, he was feeling very powerful on the day that I interviewed him. And so they've compromised by getting back these 40 pieces. But I think that all museums have gotten the message loud and clear from the Marion True case and are being very careful. And I dare say there's very little antiquities acquisition going on at all.
My guest is Sharon Waxman. Her book, Loot, The Battle Over the Stolen Treasures of the Ancient World, published by Times Books. One art dealer that you, quote, observed that if it wasn't for people illegally digging up stuff, there wouldn't be museums.
It's sort of a tautology. Yeah, well, there's some truth to that, but it's kind of revelatory about how museum. I mean, if you asked a museum official, they would never say anything like that, but it reflects some of the realities of the antiquities trade.
Well, in Mexico, the artists Diego Rivera and Rufino Tamayo put together great pre-Columbian art collections purchased from looters. Is the situation different because the works remained in the country that they were looted in?
No. They become international causes that those, I mean, in many cases, these are people who have political agendas. These are convenient targets, big American museums, big European museums. America's not very popular in the world. And these are ways to get a lot of attention. I'm not denying that there's some real historic injustice and there's real feeling of a lack of respect or a lack of recalibrating the proper balance in terms of history. And of course, you know, we do have to recognize that collecting antiquities that have been smuggled fuels that market. And so Italy has been trying to shut that down in the ways that it can.
To some degree, it's almost like the ivory trade, because there's another factor that nobody talks about. It's not just stealing a country's historical legacy, but the looters will destroy an archaeological site and really mess up a lot of things that we might have learned about history that we will never know.
Yeah, it's a very profound problem. That's exactly right. And so museums' argument, which Philippe de Montebello has made during his 40 years as director of the Metropolitan, which is we can't ignore these pieces when they are offered to us. They've already been dug up. If we decline to acquire them, then where will they go? They'll be orphaned. But, of course, that ignores the other half of the problem, which is that fueling that market does exactly what you say, is that it encourages the destruction of archaeological sites. So you have this kind of standoff, in fact, not just between these source countries that tend to be less powerful and less rich and the more powerful countries that have the great museums, but also between the world of art history and the world of archaeology.
Do we know what Thomas P. Campbell, who's taking over for Philippe de Montebello in January, thinks about all of this?
I would really like to know. I don't know what he thinks of this, but this is a really, I think, a great opportunity for Tom Campbell to shift the attitude of the Metropolitan as regards this issue. I learned, because I was writing an opinion piece about that very question, that the Met quietly has adopted, just in July, without telling anybody, this 1970 cutoff date that I mentioned earlier that UNESCO has recommended. And this has been kind of Philippe de Montebello's one of his calling cards, that he continues to collect antiquities under the rules that he thinks are best, and that they've declined to adopt that 1970 cutoff date. Well, they quietly did just after, around the time Philippe is retiring and Tom Campbell's coming. So he has a real opportunity to sort of start a new chapter in the history of the Met.
So you think that museums like the Met may go start culling their collections? Well, this one came to us after 1970. We have to send it back?
The Met does not have a good record of coming clean about the way in which it acquired pieces. And so, but I should say at the same time, neither does anybody else. But it has responded like, as I discover, institutions do respond, which is they circle the wagons, they pull up the moat, and they wait until a lawsuit lands. And that's what happened in the case of Lydian Hoard That is a story that I tell in the book. And that's, of course, what was going on with the Euphrotias crater, although it didn't get to a lawsuit, but that was they were close. They were, as I also tell in the book, the Italians had a very direct, had direct words with Philippe de Montebello in Rome and threatened to bring a lawsuit against Dietrich von Bothmer, who was a respected curator who had long retired, is an elderly man.
It also involves all the looting that the Nazis did, and there are still lawsuits seem filed every day, trying to regain things that parents and grandparents had owned and are now in major collections all throughout the world.
Yeah. I do think that this current sort of battle over restitution between source countries and Western countries is somehow a follow-on from the lawsuits and such over looted Nazi art, because I think that those countries kind of couldn't help but notice that these pieces were going back to families.
But there's a difference between a personal suit and a national suit, isn't
there? There is a difference, and also I find the issues not to be nearly as clear-cut from a moral point of view. A family that was despoiled and murdered has, to me, it's not a great dispute over whether you should give a painting back, even if it happens to be on the wall of the Austrian State Museum. Not quite the same when you're talking about a piece that might have been legally acquired 200 years ago, and someone decides that this is my cultural identity and I need to claim it. Well, what happens if in 10 years you decide that 10 more pieces are part of your cultural identity and you need those back?
Can you tell us what happened to the Baghdad Museum in 2003?
It was looted.
So it was a museum that was looted. It wasn't a grave or
the museum was. Well, that's a different situation. And I'm not treating situations like Iraq and other war-torn places in the book, because I don't think that there's much discussion over whether we should be sending stuff back to places like Iraq that has more existential concerns. Nonetheless, I mean, I do think that we, the United States, have some culpability in the looting of that museum, because we knew better. We should have helped to protect it, and our soldiers stood by while it was looted. That said, I should say there is a good book by the Colonel Matthew Bogdanos, who was sent to try to retrieve some of these pieces in the wake of that looting, and I believe there's about 3,000 to 5,000 pieces that are still missing. But I just saw the Iraqi ambassador last week, because I was speaking about the book in Washington, and he was telling me, which I've heard from other sources to be true, that there is just rampant looting going on today in Iraq, not in the museum, but elsewhere.
Well, have the pieces that were stolen from the Baghdad Museum turned up elsewhere?
They've not turned up in other museums, if that's what you mean.
They may be in private collections.
Yeah, but we don't know what's in private collections. If you bought something that was published as part of the Baghdad Museum, and you decide that you're, let's just say, immoral enough to buy it instead of return it, then you are not going to reveal that to the public.
If the museums and the gallery owners adopt stricter guidelines about acquiring antiquities, do you think that will cut down on the prospect of looting back in the original sites?
Yes, I think it does cut down on looting, and I think that there is less. The tombaroli in Italy have been largely diminished there, because that used to be a very passed down from family to family in villages. But the thing about art, the thing about beautiful objects is that people will always want to possess them, and people will always want to possess. Put their hands on pieces of ancient history. And so it just kind of moves elsewhere. So now there is rampant looting that goes on in places like Albania and Bulgaria, which don't have the money and the resources to protect their sites, and that have great treasures from the Greek period, for example. And Iraq, as I mentioned, has ongoing rampant looting. And I know just from other reporting I've done, it's not so much in the book, but in Asia, in Vietnam, Cambodia, a lot of looting continues to go on, because there will always be people who want to acquire objects of beauty.
Do you think that the Getty Museum will be cleaned out as a result of what's happening with Marion True?
The Getty has, I think it's cut its deal now with Italy. That was a very big blow, 40 major pieces, including, for example, a statue of Aphrodite that they acquired for $18 million. It's just gone, that statue.
Do they swallow that cost?
They just swallow it. And by the way, not just the Getty. You have private donors like Shelby White in the city of New York, who returned pieces of her private, legally bought collection to Italy and to Greece this year to avoid the threat of lawsuit from them. So what the Getty has gained, though, in making that deal with Italy is they now have access to all kinds of beautiful long-term loans that Italy is going to give them, including this exhibit from Bernini, all kinds of pieces by the sculptor that had not been sent out of the country before. So there is the prospect of other solutions, namely long-term loans is just one of them. But if you can come to a place of more cooperation rather than the antagonism that's kind of currently in the atmosphere, I think all kinds of possibilities are out there.
Well, I could see where a collector who spent a lot of money on a piece thinking that it was perfectly legal to buy it might be reluctant to just say, okay, I'm going to send it back. This is similar to what has happened in Berlin, where people bought houses in 1970 that turned out to have been taken from Jews as a result of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Both sides have legitimate arguments, and maybe some fund has to be developed that makes people more amenable to giving up the treasure.
It depends. I think there has to be some other way of changing the terms of this conversation, because the entire cycle of exhibition and the life of a museum is affected. If a donor has bought beautiful objects but is afraid that if they should put them on display or they publish them in a catalog that they open themselves up to the threat of a restitution demand, then they're just not going to do it. They're just going to keep it in their living room. And that hurts museums, and that hurts the general public, because we all want to see these things. We all want to learn from them and benefit from them. So one of the things that I call on museums to do in the book is to be more open and to be candid about the history of the pieces that are in their collections.
Details on Sharon Waxman's new book, her entertainment and media news blog, and her panel discussion tonight that will be at NYU can be found on our show page at WNYC.org. The book Loot, The Battle Over the Stolen Treasures of the Ancient World is published by Times Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.